You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Monday, March 7th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Great show for you today. Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone will be joining us to explain why Wall Street isn't in jail. This is also a reference to his latest piece, coincidentally, in Rolling Stone, entitled Why Isn't Wall Street in Jail? We'll be mixing up the grammar with him. That's what we will be doing when he shows up on this program. We've got another great week of politics and fun for you this week, ladies. Chris Hayes will be here later in the week, among others. We may actually, I'm thinking about bringing on somebody who's actually trying cases, civil litigation against Wall Street, just to get a sense of if there's any chance to hold these people accountable for wrecking our economy. My magic eight ball says highly unlikely, but we shall see. And of course, we'll have other programming opportunities for you. If you can become a member, please do. You support this program and you get all sorts of bennies. We're going to start loading up that members only section very soon. And at my household, it is time for us to get some more coffee from justcoffee.coop. We use the coupon code MAJORITY and we get a 10% discount. And we get great coffee. And I forgot to read that email about had someone write in, almost seemingly angry at me that I wasn't talking about the quality of the Just Co-op tea. And, of course, also you can support the show by clicking on our Amazon link on majority.fm, bookmarking it, and buying all your Amazon crap from there. That includes digital downloads, books, streaming videos, computer stuff, whatever it is, housewares. If you insist on supporting the corporate behemoths, at the very least, you should be redistributing their wealth to programming you love. Let's jump right in. Brief update on what's going on in the Middle East. It continues. Meanwhile, in Egypt, protesters over the weekend stormed several locked offices belonging to the former regime's secret police. Say the documents they found contain evidence of phone tapping, election rigging, and torture. Activists broke into secret police headquarters in Cairo and Alexandria. The Mubarak regime used the secret police to torture opponents and monitor any resistance within the population. I wonder when they're going to find the documents that show that Omar, is that his first name, Suleiman? Basically our retail torture guy in Egypt, we would extraordinarily render prisoners to Egypt, and he would be in charge. He would greet them, give them a Hawaiian lei when they came off that CIA-rented airplane, and then proceed to put their testicles attached to an electric car battery, get false confessions that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. You'll remember this is what they did with al-Libi. And then use that as a justification to lie, or I guess I should say a means in which to lie this country into war. So it'll be interesting to see if that is revealed. Of course, we know all of that, at least in part because of the WikiLeaks cables. State security has never served to protect this state's security. Its real function was to protect the regime. State security was never there to protect us. All they did was set their thugs on us and spy, said one protester. They found torture tools, various forms of electric shocks. And there were also plans found to rig the 2010 parliamentary elections. More as that develops. And, of course, in Libya, I would say it's probably now a full-on civil war. And it's really impossible, at least from what I have seen, to get to gather who has the momentum, what's happening. All we know is that Gaddafi is strafing his own people with fighter jets. And there is some debate as to whether or not and what would be involved in enforcing a no-fly zone. It would involve, according to Gates, and John Kerry spoke to this, it would involve basically firing upon their airports, their hangars, grounding the Libyan Air Force. It's unclear whether or not we will do that. And in the post show, I will address an email where someone was pretty shocked that I would even suggest that I had, on principle, no problem with, in any way, arming or resupplying parts of the Libyan people. And I will discuss that in the post-show. One note, though, of course, John McCain was on TV this weekend because it was Sunday, and I don't think there is anything that John McCain will ever do. I mean, when this guy dies, they will wheel his body out on Sundays and put him down there. And it doesn't matter what he says, because most of it's lies and full of crap anyways. Via Atrios, on whatever Sunday show he was on this weekend, who knows what it was, it was probably Meet the Press, McCain on Gaddafi. Now, I want to just remind you, it is 2011. It is March of 2011 right now. Gaddafi, referring to Gaddafi, he's insane, but perhaps the people around him would begin to depart the sinking ship and buy again a no-fly zone, declaring our assistance or support of a provisional government, perhaps which is being formed up now. There's a lot of steps we can take providing significant humanitarian aid. On August 2009, on McCain's Twitter feed, late evening with Colonel Gaddafi at his, quote, ranch in Libya. Interesting meeting with an interesting man. One day earlier, as reported in Reuters, August 14th, 2009, U.S. Republican Senator John McCain praised Libya's leader Muammar Gaddafi for his peacekeeping role in Africa and said Congress would support expanding ties. And Atrios adds, for good measure, ties? Oh, ties. Since Washington ended its major sanctions on Libya, U.S. energy companies, including ExxonMobil and Chevron, have been active in Libya. In other words, there's no ties severed, and John McCain can say whatever he wants at any time and still be praised as the elder statesman who gave us Sarah Palin. Congratulations, mainstream media. Certainly holding up your end of the bargain in being not mainstream or media, really. I mentioned this on the post show on Friday, and then I spoke about it more with Mike Malloy on his program, 10 p.m. Eastern, and I think I'm going to do that more often. Go on to Mike's program on Fridays. I think he expressed some interest in that, and it's so much fun talking to Mike. Very entertaining show, and you hear a lot of stories you don't hear other places. And really, all I had to say about this in the post show was, as far as I can recall, was more or less just a constant stream of swearing on my part. Because this story is so reprehensible. It is so stunning. You know that Bradley Manning, the private, who was an intelligence officer in Iraq, and at one point just hit the wall where he could no longer support this government because of what it was doing in Iraq, specifically because he had been ordered to essentially track and harass Iraqis who were just expressing dissent with the government. They weren't doing anything violent. And that's when he hit his wall. And allegedly, then uploaded materials to WikiLeaks site. Thousands of these cables that we have referenced, images of U.S. firing on Iraqis, et cetera, et cetera. That's all allegedly. He has been in prison now for over a year and a half. The charges keep changing based upon the American government's belief in whether or not they can convince him to in any way finger Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, which they now admit they cannot. He has been left in solitary confinement for 23 hours out of the day. He is not allowed to exercise in his cell. He is not given a pillow. He is essentially being tortured. There has never been a suggestion that he would be dangerous to other people. To the extent that he's been suggested that he would be a danger to himself, they have not been able to get a single psychiatrist on at Quantico to sign off on that. He has not gotten his speedy trial. People who have visited him have been harassed repeatedly. And as of March 5th, and this is ongoing, according to the New York Times, according to both his attorney and to Charlie Savage in the New York Times, the brig at Quantico has repeatedly and is systemically and as now normal practice, stripping Manning of all his clothing for the past three nights, starting back on March 2nd, they continue to practice this indefinitely. They strip him naked every night. They make him go to roll call in the morning, standing at attention, naked. The defense, this speaking of himself, communicated with PFC Manning and the brig forensic psychiatrist, learned more about the decision to strip him of his clothing every night. On Wednesday, March 2nd, Manning was told that Article 138 complaint requesting that he be removed from maximum custody and prevention of injury watch. He is on this POI watch, had been denied by the Quantico commander. Despite the fact that Press Secretary Jeff Morrell of the Pentagon has said that Manning has been nothing short of exemplary as a detainee, despite the fact that brig forensic psychiatrists have consistently maintained there is no mental health justification for the POI watch imposed on Manning, Manning then remarked that the POI restrictions were absurd and sarcastically stated that if he wanted to harm himself, he could conceivably do so with the elastic waistband of his underwear or with his flip-flops. So without consulting any brig mental health provider, the chief warrant officer used Manning's sarcastic quip as justification to increase the restrictions imposed upon him under the guise of being concerned that Manning was a suicide risk. Because suicide risk watch would require a brig mental health provider's recommendation, which the brig commander cannot secure. In response to this specific incident, the brig psychiatrist assessed PFC Manning as, quote, low risk and requiring only routine outpatient follow-up with no need for closer clinical observation. In particular, he indicated that Manning's statement about the waistband and his underwear was no way prompted by a psychiatric condition. In other words, they're using this as an excuse to break him down, as a punitive torture device. I quote via Digby, the CIA memo describing combined interrogation techniques in December 30th of 2004 used against Iraqi and Afghani prisoners. Establishing the baseline state is important to demonstrate to the HVD, this is the prisoner, that he has no control over basic human needs. The baseline state also creates in the detainee a mindset in which he learns to perceive and value his personal welfare, comfort, and immediate needs more than the information he is protecting. What information is Bradley Manning protecting? The use of conditioning techniques do not generally bring immediate results. Rather, it is the cumulative effect of these techniques used over time and in combination with other interrogation techniques and intelligence exploitation methods which achieve interrogation objectives. These conditioning techniques require little or no physical interaction between the detainee and the interrogator. The specific interrogation techniques are A. Nudity. The HVD clothes are taken and remains nude until the interrogators provide clothes to him. These methods were approved by Rumsfeld at Gitmo on December 2nd in 2002. They were approved in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2003. They are torturing this guy in the hopes that he will give them some type of false confession. They recently charged him the other day with aiding the enemy, a eligible for the death sentence. This is all just a coincidence. This is happening in our country. These are not just rogue elements taking pictures of nude men in pyramids in Iraq. And John Kerry, all he has to say about it, well, it's good that people are starting to look into this. It's disgusting. It is an incredible shame. There is no way President Obama is not aware of this. No way. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with Matt Taibbi.
Hey folks, as I always say, your membership is the only thing that will ensure we can keep doing this show. So please, if you can, join today at Majority.fm. Not only will you support the show, you'll get an extra 50 minutes of the show every day, plus all sorts of other membership goodies. But if you can't become a member, you can still support the show in other ways by virtually doing nothing. Head to Majority.fm. Find the Majority FM Amazon.com graphic. Click on it, bookmark it, buy goods from Amazon as you normally would, and you'll actually be redistributing wealth from a corporate behemoth to the independent media you listen to daily. That means me. It's simple, and it really helps. So please, if you can do it, do it. And you can also donate your Twitter account for one retweet daily at Majority.fm. Thanks.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. We have Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone and RollingStone.com. He blogs there on Taibbi Blog. Welcome back to the program, Matt.
Hey, Sam. What's going on, man?
Not much. You have a good vacation?
I did. Tanned, rested, and ready.
So jealous. So jealous. Meanwhile, this... another blockbuster story, and in Rolling Stone, why isn't Wall Street in prison? It's a great question. The answer is rather depressing. You know, we know the implications of what Wall Street did. We see it in terms of crashing the stock market and creating sort of a mini shock doctrine environment where people can pretend that union pensions are underfunded when in fact they simply suffered the same thing that everybody else's pension suffered. You got John Kasich in Ohio. Before we get into this, tell people about John Kasich in Ohio. This guy's this is wonderful. He goes from Fox News into basically destroying our economy and then trying to further the conservative agenda in Ohio.
Yeah, Kasich is great because he's such a perfect symbol of the entire crisis. I mean, he worked for Lehman Brothers in Ohio, and he was instrumental in getting the state of Ohio and its pension fund to buy $400 million worth of investments with Lehman Brothers, which, you know, including toxic mortgage-backed securities and that sort of thing, which generally speaking is what happened a lot during the crisis. The banks had these mismarked mortgage-backed securities, and they were selling them as AAA-rated investments to suckers like pension funds and insurance companies and that sort of thing. And the pension funds went broke, and now everybody's blaming the pensioners, the firefighters and the policemen and the teachers who are collecting these pensions, when in fact they were just victims. They were people who were basically, they're like the, you know, the victims of Bernie Madoff. They were buying toxic assets that were presented to them as good assets, and now they're busted. So Kasich, you know, he sells the stuff to the state pension fund, and then as governor he tries to break the unions and the pensions, the pensioners that are collecting this stuff. It's just a perfect metaphor.
And do you think now I think, you know, I've been doing some reading, and one of the things that has stuck out to me, you know, particularly as I start to look over this financial crisis inquiry report, is that you had guys in 2005, 2006, it was very clear there was a real problem with these mortgages. It was out there, for sure. I mean, to the extent that, I mean, I was talking about it. And if I was talking about it, that meant that there was at least a lot of other people out there at certain quarters talking about it. And you still had those products sold even more because hedge fund guys were helping promote these products so they could bet that they would fail. Do you think Kasich was one of these guys who was aware? Was he benefiting, or was he just a moron who was like, oh, okay, it's signed off, I can find some dumb money out there and sell these too?
Well, I mean, there's that's kind of the, you know, trillion-dollar question on Wall Street is, to what extent were the banks aware of the fact that these, you know, the products they were selling were defective and risky and likely to blow up? And I think the answer is the really, you know, on a larger meta sense, I think most of the banks knew that the stuff they were selling is garbage. But on another level, I think they just were indifferent. They were, you know, it was irrelevant to them whether or not the products they had were toxic because they knew they had a market for it. They, you know, essentially what these guys were doing is they had invented these derivative instruments that allowed them to take big pools of really, really risky subprime mortgages and then sort of reconfigure them and chop them up and sell them as AAA rated securities, which they had a huge market for because they were AAA, but they paid more, higher rates of return than other AAA rated investments like T-bills. So they could, once they figured out that they could sell this stuff to pensions and insurance companies and foreign banks and all that, it didn't even matter to them what the actual product was. They were just interested in creating as much of this stuff as they could, and then they were selling it as quickly as possible. So I don't think they really cared, I think is more the answer. Whether or not they knew, they just didn't care.
Right. Now,
does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's the bottom line for a lot of those guys. I mean, I think there were smarter players in the market who understood that these things were crap, and they, I think, probably also sort of encouraged the sale of this stuff so they could turn around and sell it. It's almost like, you know, I'm selling used cars where I've turned back the odometer and I know that the entire chassis, the back half of the chassis, falls off, but I also happen to have a huge business selling and making back-end chassis of cars.
Right.
And so I'm going to encourage the sale of these things.
Clearly, by 2006, 2007, and the early part of 2008, a lot of the banks were clued in and were betting heavily against these same instruments. They were, you know, what they call net short on mortgage-backed securities because they knew that this was going to blow up. So clearly by then, yeah, definitely, they knew.
Well, that's just fantastic. So one would expect that in this mess of people who clearly were engaged on some level in fraud, at the very least by saying, like, hey, this stuff is this is a triple A investment. You're definitely going to make your money. We have the question as to why there has not been a single conviction on some level, but why we haven't seen a rash of people perp walked out of Wall Street.
Well, it's a really complicated question. It has a complicated answer. I think it comes down to an institutional unwillingness to pursue cases against high-level banking officials. And why do they have that unwillingness? There are a lot of reasons. Number one, I think the biggest one is that the SEC and the Department of Justice has been corrupted by this whole revolving door issue. We have a situation now where the top cops on Wall Street, people who work in the SEC and the Department of Justice, they basically without exception, they leave government service after a couple of years and they jump to multi-million-dollar partnerships at corporate defense firms in Manhattan and in Washington. So they're essentially all like college basketball players waiting for their first big NBA deal, and they're not going to imperil their jobs by, you know, taking on Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs, because that's who's going to be hiring them 2 years down the road. And it's a lot of money. I mean, it's not an inconsequential amount of money. This is being set for life. So I think that's the number one reason.
And it's not just that, you know, I mean, I know guys who work in that area, but it's also that even if they have integrity in what they're pursuing at that time, the bottom line is that their bosses are good buddies with attorneys that they were working with on the other side, and who have come from that system. And so there's just a collegiality. I mean, you mention it in your piece. I mean, this is what ultimately the answer of your piece is. But they'll go to conferences together and they'll sit around and drink. And these are there's just one big old good old boy network in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, I think the example that I keep coming back to, there's this one case involving an investigator named Gary Aguirre who was trying to pursue an insider trading case that involved John Mack, who at the time was the CEO of Morgan Stanley. And the most representative thing about this case was when he was sending subpoenas to Morgan Stanley for information about this case, and here's how the subpoenas were getting answered. Morgan Stanley's lawyer was Mary Jo White, who was the former U.S. attorney of the Southern District of New York. Now, she had quit, and she worked for Debevoise and Plimpton, which is a big defense firm here in New York. They got Mary Jo White to send the answers to those subpoenas directly to Linda Thompson, the head of the SEC's Director of Enforcement. So imagine this. Imagine you're a detective in New York, and you're investigating a drug dealer, and you send a subpoena to somebody, and he calls up the chief of police personally and answers the subpoena that way. That's basically the situation you have here. You had low-level investigators trying to pursue the case, but the potential defendants, are communicating directly with guys five and six levels above you. And I don't know how you pursue a case in that situation.
This is sort of the only metaphor here, the only analogy, I guess, is regulatory capture. I mean, this is the same thing that happens to the EPA or to the, you know, mind safety agency when it is essentially run by people for a couple of years from the mining industry, and they just keep rotating through.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it's a total merry-go-round of like-minded lawyers who all come from the same educational system. They hang out with the same people, and they hire each other. A great example is the current director of enforcement at the SEC is Robert Khuzami. Khuzami, his last job was as the chief legal counsel of Deutsche Bank. He had been hired at Deutsche Bank by Dick Walker, who was the previous SEC Director of Enforcement. And Walker himself had been hired, at the SEC. He had been appointed after serving another job, on Wall Street. So it's like this endless train of people who hire each other. They go from Wall Street back to, government service and then back to Wall Street again. And, it's supposed to be an adversarial system, but it really isn't, is what it comes down to.
Explain to us what the relationship is between the SEC and the Department of Justice, because the SEC is supposed to sort of investigate this stuff and then pass it to the Department of Justice for sort of criminal investigations. Is that right?
Right, yeah. The SEC does not have criminal prosecutorial power, so... but they also are really the only agency that has experts in this kind of crime. I mean, the FBI does have a few people who pursue these kinds of cases, but for the most part, this is very complicated stuff, and you need people who understand the material, and the investigators are all going to come primarily from the SEC. So they're supposed to work the cases, and then if they have enough to pursue criminal charges, they're supposed to refer it to the Department of Justice, where a U.S. attorney or a prosecutor will take the case to criminal court. That's kind of the way it's supposed to work. What's been happening lately is that the SEC is acting more like a middleman, where they'll work the case for a while, then they'll have communications with the defendants, and they'll negotiate a way out of criminal charges for the defendant. They'll say, here, you can pay $400 million for a fine, and then we'll find out whether or not you're going to have criminal charges pressed, and we'll make that go away if you pay the money. And that's kind of the way it's worked out.
And so how does a guy like Madoff, I mean, I guess Madoff just gets caught because it was just so egregious, and everybody he seemed to have stung had access to a newspaper.
Yeah, no, Madoff, well, there's a bunch of reasons that Madoff ended up in jail. First of all, they tried as hard as they could to not deal with Bernie Madoff and not put him in jail. I mean, they had a detailed dossier on this guy, as early as 1999. They had somebody come to him, to the SEC, in the early part of the last decade and point out that Madoff, only his accounting firm was like in a strip mall and only had three employees, and one of them was a 78-year-old woman in Florida. And, it wasn't like Bernie Madoff was a criminal mastermind who was eluding detection. He was basically right out in the open running a Ponzi scheme. And the SEC blew it off for like 8 years, and then it finally blew up, and he came to their doorstep with a confession, gift wrap. There was no way they could not press that case. So even though he's an example of a conviction, it's also an example of how they do business. They ignored it for 8 years and didn't do anything about it till they had no choice.
And to be fair, my understanding is that Bernie Madoff from his prison said that he really did try to get his friends out. But he couldn't always get him out, without telling him what he was up to. So, that's sort of their fault.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
What is the relationship between what we've seen here about these sort of individuals who, were obviously, like you tell a story about John Mack, there's clearly reason to believe that he was involved in insider trading. You talk about AIG's Joe Cassano, sort of lying to shareholders and whatnot. But what is the relationship between the failure of the SEC and the DOJ to pursue these individual cases and the systemic failure of our system to function in a transparent and, productive manner?
Well, it has enormous ramifications when guys can't be prosecuted criminally, because there's no fear. When you're working in one of these companies now and you come to this moral crossroads, should I commit a technical violation that might make me $50 million, or should I toe the line and obey the law? There's no longer really any incentive to take that latter course. You might as well break the law now, because there's really almost no situation where you're going to be personally held liable for committing a crime anymore on Wall Street. You know, throughout this entire financial crisis, even the guys who got caught, there were only a couple of people, two officials from Citigroup, who ended up having personally to pay fines, and their fines were like $80,000 and $100,000, you know, respectively, which is nothing. Even Angelo Mozzillo at Countrywide, and he was as, you know, brazen and open a criminal as Bernie Madoff was, even he ended up getting to keep like, you know, two-thirds of his net worth after the SEC got done with him. So there's just no incentive anymore for these guys to obey the law, which is a huge problem.
You know, you wrote, this is really one of there were a couple of quotes that really jumped out to me. The shocking pattern of non-enforcement with regard to Wall Street is so deeply ingrained in Washington that it raises a profound and difficult question about the very nature of our society. Whether we have created a class of people whose misdeeds are no longer perceived as crimes, almost no matter what those misdeeds are. A former chief accountant for the SEC, Lynn Turner, said, "I think you've got the wrong assumption that we even have a law enforcement agency when it comes to Wall Street." What are we supposed to do with this? I mean, you know, we have this notion that there is absolutely nothing these players can do that would result in any type of accountability. I mean, we have gone from essentially sinking the world's economy, forcing the continued bailout, free money that these people are getting, their insider trading, and we don't seem to have any means in which to hold them accountable. What happens next?
Well, you know, I think this is really something that has to be worked out in the American psyche, first of all, because we really, you know, when we look at these people, a lot of Americans have a problem with viewing the kind of stuff that went on Wall Street as a crime. Now, you take somebody who, like, deals drugs or steals a car, you'll never see somebody get up in court and say, you know, "Your Honor, I recognize that my client's guilty, but what would, you know, if you put him in jail, would that really stop car theft? Would that really stop people from dealing drugs?" You know, you would never see those kinds of excuses made, but we see this all the time with Wall Street guys. You see the argument made in court proceedings and in negotiations. Yes, these guys hid $100 billion in liabilities from their shareholders, but would putting them in jail really accomplish anything? Would it stop phony accounting if we find these guys personally? We make excuses for these people, and we wonder what you know punishing them would do. And I think that's a problem that all of us have. We just don't. You know, there's this attitude that these are productive members of society, therefore we should go easy on them. Whereas people who commit ordinary street crimes, they deserve to go to jail every time they break the law. And I think that's just something that has to be worked out in our heads.
Right. There's some type of like a relationship between perceiving rich people as inherently more moral than the rest of us.
Right. And productive too. That's the other thing is, oh, you know, if we put this guy in jail, we're going to lose this productive member of society. You know, forgetting the fact that this person has been a destructive member of society. That's the other thing. And you know, people say, oh, these are victimless crimes. Well, okay, if you have a guy who sells somebody an 8-ball of coke on the street, you know, that's two consenting adults engaging in a technically illegal economic transaction. But if you have somebody who works for, you know, JP Morgan Chase or one of these companies and he sells the state pension fund of Wisconsin $50 million of toxic mortgage assets, I mean, what they're really doing is stealing the life savings of, you know, pensioners and old people. I mean, that's not a victimless crime. If you wake up tomorrow morning and half your pension is gone because these guys worked out this crooked deal, you know, that is definitely not that's a very, very destructive crime. And I think people just they don't understand that yet because it seems like a legitimate business transaction.
Yeah, you know, and I can't recall the paper off the top of my head, but it was out of Britain, which showed that the amount of wealth destroyed in this meltdown far supersedes the amount of wealth created by the financial industry. And so the notion that they're productive on the most basic level is a complete fallacy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They're really just sucking up at this point government subsidies and gouging customers for fees and services, and they're not really creating any wealth. They're just continually shaving, you know, the pie down until there's nothing left. They're not creating anything. They're just sort of engineering the money away in surcharges, kind of the same way a casino would.
All right, Matt Taibbi of RollingStone.com. Folks, I can't implore you enough to read this piece. We'll link to it, obviously, at majority.fm, or you can pick up the paper copy. Apparently, they still make paper copies of magazines. That's what I've heard. And get your attitudes right about money, folks, because you're getting ripped off. Thanks, Matt.
All right, thanks a lot, Sam. Talk to you soon, man.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back for just a couple more minutes because I got a couple more things to say in the full show. We'll be back in just a minute. All right, we're back. I just wanted to touch on what's going on with these protests, what the implications of what Matt Taibbi was talking about. 30,000 people protested in Trenton, New Jersey.
Yes.
That's a nice way to spend a Saturday. Head down to Trenton. Teachers, police officers, state workers filled the street around the state house to rally against Governor Chris Christie and the budget cuts. State police said the crowd was between 30 and 35,000 people, making it the largest protest ever staged in Trenton. No arrests were reported. "We are not the problem. We are not the problem," chanted the crowd full of teachers. And they're right. And I want to reiterate something about Chris Christie. I think I've said this before. I'm going to keep saying it over and over again. Please run. There are going to be 2 days in the political career of Chris Christie that I can't wait for. The first day is the day that he announces he is running for president. The second day that I'm going to cherish is the day after the Republican primary in New Hampshire when he drops out of the race. You thought Rudy Giuliani was a flame out. Wait till you get a load of this guy. The exact same profile, short of him having a distinctly larger profile than Rudy Giuliani. Now, I don't want you to get the impression that I believe that if Chris Christie were as fit as Rudy Giuliani, that he would also take his guma to a 9/11 donated apartment to have sex with her. I don't want you to get the impression that I'm saying if Chris Christie were thin or was a mayor like Rudy Giuliani, that he would have placed the emergency center in Building 7 of the World Trade Center so that he could have trysts with people he was having an affair with instead of listening to his emergency responders, managers who were saying, you should put this in Brooklyn, which would have saved hundreds of police and firemen lives. That's not my point. And no, my point is not that Chris Christie has a number two who is mobbed up and will end up in jail just years after he was appointed police commissioner and proposed to be the head of Homeland Security. That's not my point. My point is Chris Christie has no future in the National Republican Party like Rudy Giuliani, and it's just a countdown until he goes into the private industry and uses all his connections to suck on the public teat, like Rudy Giuliani does with his so-called security firm, which just basically garners a bunch of Homeland Security contracts. That's my point. But back to what I was referring to, you've got protests across the country and against these moves by these right-wing governors to destroy unions. A piece in McClatchy on the 6th saying that it is in fact not the case that public employees are bankrupting, nor their pensions are bankrupting states. There's simply no evidence that state pensions are the current burden to public finances, writes Kevin G. Hall from McClatchy Newspapers. Pension contributions from state and local employers are not blowing budgets up. They amount to just 2.9% of state spending on average, is according to the National Association of State Retirement Administrators. The Center for Retirement Research at Boston College puts the figure a bit higher at 3.8%. So we know it's somewhere between 2.9 and 3.8% of states' budgets. That's not what's sinking state budgets, folks. There's no direct comparison, but state and local pension contributions approximate the burden shouldered by private companies as well. Nor are state and local government pensions funds broke. Like investments held in 401k plans by American private sector employees, they are sunk along with the entire stock market. They sunk along with the entire stock market during the Great Recession of 07 to 09. And like 401k plans, the investments made by public sector pensions plans are increasingly on firmer footing as Wall Street rises. Boston College researchers project that if the assets in state and local pension plans were frozen tomorrow and there was no more growth in investment returns, there'd still be enough money in most state plans to pay benefits for years to come. So this is for your right-wing relatives, friends. State unions are killing state budgets. Not only are state unions not killing state budgets, not only do they get paid on par 5% less than their counterparts in the private sector when you control for education, their pension obligations are also not killing state budgets. 3.9% is the outside, is the highest figure that they could possibly be eating up on state government budgets. In 1980, just to give you a sense of how defined contribution and defined benefit programs have changed. You know that a defined contribution plan is one where every month, every payroll, you are told there will always be a specific amount of money that you put in. State pensions are not defined contribution. They are defined benefit. In other words, you know exactly how much you're going to get out. That means you have to reverse engineer that if you're a state pension administrator and come up with a figure that you have to put in based upon your investment returns on what you're going to get that amount that's going to get automatically be paid out. In 1980, this is just an example of how corporations in this country and how right-wingers want to destroy your ability to have a safe and secure investment pension when you retire. In 1980, 84% of workers at medium and large companies in the U.S. had a defined benefit plan, like those that still predominate in the public sector. By last year, after Reagan and these corporatists in the Democratic Party got through with it, just 30% of workers in these larger companies were covered under such plans. We went from the overwhelming majority of Americans who work at large and medium-sized corporations having a defined benefit program plan for their pension. I know exactly how much I'm going to have. I'm going to be able to plan for my retirement. This is going to be one leg of the three-legged stool of my retirement, the second leg being Social Security. The third leg being any other assets I've accumulated. And now only 30% of Americans working in private sector, medium and large corporations have a notion as to what that benefit's going to be. And if you look at things like United Airlines or U.S. Steel, They're completely allowed to go into bankruptcy and rewrite that and screw over their employees, sometimes giving them no pension. You hear right-wingers over and over again saying the stimulus was simply a payoff to public sector unions. Two out of every three public sector workers aren't even union members. So your stimulus is not going to pay for unions. 40% of that stimulus was tax cuts. The other 60%, to the extent that it goes to anybody in state or local workers or public sector workers, however you want to call it, only two out of three of them were unions. So this attack on unions is nothing more than an attack on unions. It is an attack on workers' ability to organize and to get a measure of economic and political power. Just saying that now is demonized. Just saying that unions allow for workers to have political and economic power is demonized. It should be said with pride. Because if you look at the statistics, if you look at where workers are today, they need it. If you wonder why Matt Taibbi is right about no enforcement for those people on Wall Street, if you wonder why corporations are sitting on record profits and record money, $2 trillion in capital reserves, record profits out the wazoo, and wages have been stagnant for 30 years, you understand that workers need every ability they have to gain some political and economic power. And the loss of that power has led to the greatest income disparity we've had in this country since the Baron robber age. It should be said with pride that unions increase the power, the political and economic power of workers. That's what they are explicitly for. And in fact, the number of state workers has gone down over the past 10 years and 3 years. And in fact, Wisconsin's public sector pension plan still has enough assets today to cover more than 18 years of benefits. So you've got shrinking state and local government payrolls, and you've got pensions that are completely funded, and yet these attacks on unions continue. That is because this is an explicit fight. We are in a class war. And I'm going to assume that none of you are millionaires and billionaires at the moment. Maybe we have some millionaires. I don't know. But you're losing. The vast majority of people who are listening to me are losing. Let's end with Michael Moore in Madison, Wisconsin. We will post the YouTube of his entire speech on our blog, but it was very inspiring. Here he is speaking to thousands in Madison on Saturday.
America is not broke. Contrary to what those in power would like you to believe, so that you'll give up your pension, cut your wages, and settle for the life your great-grandparents had, America is not broke. Not by a long shot. The country is awash in wealth and cash. It's just that it's not in your hands. It has been transferred in the greatest heist in history from the workers and consumers to the banks and the portfolios of the uber rich. Right now, this afternoon, just 400 Americans, 400, have more wealth than half of all Americans combined. Let me say that again. And please, someone in the mainstream media, just repeat this fact once. We're not greedy. We'll be happy to hear it just once. 400 obscenely wealthy individuals, 400 little Mubaraks, most of whom benefited in some way from the multi-trillion dollar taxpayer bailout of 2008, now have more cash, stock, and property than the assets of 155 million Americans combined. If you can't bring yourself to call that a financial coup d'etat, then you are simply not being honest with what you know in your heart to be true.
All right, folks, join me on the flip side. If you are a member, you will continue to hear the rest of the program. And if you're listening live, you'll be able to hear the rest of the program. You can IM me at Majority FM. And if you're not a member, I'm sorry. We got nothing for you. Until we're back tomorrow with another great show. I want to leave you one thing. You're getting screwed, folks. You're getting screwed. I hope it feels good. All right, we got to take a break. We'll see you on the flip side.